Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. You probably got my note that a slight but certain change in schedule. We will not meet next Monday, but resume our third seminar, July 31st, and our final seminar on August 7th. In the meantime, jot down any notes you have that we don't cover or things that you want to talk about a little bit more, and I'll extend the final seminar, and we can have just an open discussion at the top of the hour for a bit of time for any questions and things that we don't cover. But first, I'm eager to hear from you, what you're taking away that's of interest or benefit or questions and challenges that you have based on what we're talking about. We're covering, as you know, the four aspects having to do with neuroscience and the brain in terms of marketing. We talked about psychology of influence. We're going to talk about the neuroscience of persuasion today, and then mindset mastery in the third seminar, and then finally neuromarketing. And you'll see that, and it will be covered in detail in the outline. Any questions or feedback at this point about what you might have found beneficial? Can I get a mute of the background noise? Your speaker, even if it's a headset, is picking up background noise. I'd like to remain off of lecture mode for just a brief discussion. What are you taking away that might be of interest to your colleagues and to me about our first seminar, or questions you have still remaining about it? Anything? Then I'll launch into our discussion and reserve some time at the end for us to look at anything that you'd like to focus on a bit more or discuss further. So I'll put us on lecture mode so you don't have to manage the background. Okay, we're going to talk in this seminar about the neuroscience of persuasion. So here's the initial quiz. I promised to give you a quiz at the beginning of each seminar. Here's the quiz for this seminar about persuasion. Ohio State University studied several hundred undergraduates and asked them to rate how much they wanted and liked various pleasurable activities: receiving a paycheck, seeing a best friend, engaging in sexual activity, receiving a compliment or a good grade, eating a favorite food. Jot down your answer. Now here's the hint. One of these was endorsed as much as the other four combined. Undergraduates. So, persuasion, let's define that as an active process of choice architecture to get someone. I'll refer simply to a prospect, a potential client, a customer, to clearly associate a desired feeling and outcome with your product or service. The most significant thing that great persuaders understand and communicate, it's not about you, it's about them, the potential client or customer. And remember your primary question. What is it that you want to accomplish through this with that person and their needs or challenges as a point of reference? When President Abraham Lincoln was a successful lawyer prior to his presidency, he began presenting a case by establishing a positive frame for him and his clients that created a distinct advantage. He would begin his opening arguments by summing up the other side's case. He would point out the positive aspects of their position, how worthy of consideration they were, and established his credibility by demonstrating that he recognized the other side had a legitimate position and that he appreciated it. People listened carefully because his credibility was high. The judge and jury both concluded that if he were so willing to give credibility, and the client's, the other client's side, the opposition's in detail, then he must be honest and speaking from his heart. This frame of respect and understanding of the other person's point of view establishes a common ground, a connection before presenting your position. So, let's look at this aspect of persuasion neuroscience and consider the two most fundamental forces of the human psyche, the twin forces of pleasure and pain. Our aversion to loss is hardwired. We learn more quickly from pain than from pleasure because negative stimuli get more attention and response. Avoiding loss has kept us alive. There's a blog I have archived that will be a quick 2 or 3 minute read. It's called The Allure of Chaos. It's in my blog section, and just search for it there. It'll elaborate a little bit that I don't want to take time to do here in a related way. Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize by demonstrating that notions of loss are more powerful than focus on gain. He demonstrated, measured from brain recordings, that we register twice as much pain from losing $100 than the pleasure from gaining $100. This is loss aversion. This means that people are more emotionally concerned with not making a bad decision than with making the best decision. From psychology and social neuroscience, we know now the twin forces of motivation that drive all human behavior, the desire to avoid pain and the desire to seek pleasure. These two organizing principles of brain wiring to minimize danger or pain and to maximize reward or pleasure are overarching of all the functions. If we associate positive emotions or reward, we approach. If we associate negative emotions or pain, we avoid. Now, a meaning here is if someone buys, they associate more pleasure to buying than not buying. If someone doesn't buy, they associate more pain to buying than not buying. And we process the pleasure and pain cues unconsciously within a fifth of a second. Here's a master formula then for persuasion. To associate buying with getting pleasure and not buying with getting greater pain, or greater pain with action, loss with a failure to act. So some people will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure. Both avoiding pain and inertia, which means simply remaining in the status quo, not making a decision, are the two innate brain tendencies to be aware of. Short-term equals pain. Giving up their money, for example. Most people need to think long-term to be successful. Now, think about how much of what we do is to prevent pain. Paying bills, doing taxes, exercising, maintaining your house and your car. Our brains are hardwired to prevent pain, to prioritize survival over improvement. This means that our brains are primarily a mechanism for survival rather than designed for success, fulfillment, and growth. So let's apply this pain-pleasure brain formula to the three-story components that we talked about last time. The challenge, the development, the resolution. The challenge, find the need or interest that's not fulfilled, what your prospects want but are not getting. The development, show how to meet the challenge. And the resolution, clarify both the emotional and logical reasons to act in that order. People want emotionally but justify logically. So find the emotional motivators to have or be the best for their clients, to have the best relationship or skill set, to be fully informed, to be confident. Since part of persuasion focuses on avoiding pain, if you focus on the price, this adds to their pain rather than alleviating it. So a practical example is not to have your coaching fees on the website, because people make a decision based on money, and as soon as they see a figure, that sets off all kinds of associations and links in each person's mind, some of which may be similar and many of which may be different, but they make a decision prematurely based on the wrong criteria, not on a relationship, as you've had a discussion with them about your services, done a sample session to illustrate the effectiveness, and then, as part of your recommendation, end with the fee. So we keep things to avoid the regret we would experience in giving them up, including our money. Participants in a research study were given a lottery ticket and then asked if they would trade their ticket for a different one with an equal chance of winning. Significantly less than half of the participants agreed, even when they were bribed with chocolate. When the experiment was repeated with pins instead of lottery tickets, 90% of participants agreed to trade. Pins are tangible and real. Lottery tickets are a story of hope, dopamine for a dollar. People hang on to lottery tickets to hope for the best and avoid the regret they would experience if they had switched and their original ticket won. So they're willing to give up an actual pin, but not their lottery ticket. They hold on to hope. From a marketing perspective, giving somebody $100 to be applied toward a future purpose or purchase is a greater incentive than a $100 discount. Consumer psychology tells us that people will gravitate toward purchasing decisions that do one or more of these five things: reduce the fear of making a mistake, make the person feel more in control, simplify the decision process, offer simple, clear, immediate emotional benefits, and eliminate any obstacles. So, here are six principles of persuasion to apply this. Persuasion appeals deeply rooted human responses of our minds and brain. Strategies that simply inform people about facts and reasons to make changes have a high likelihood of failure. Information does not lead people to make decisions. And as I mentioned before, if information would change behavior, we'd all be thin, we'd work out every day, we'd eat mostly vegetables, we'd have significant money saved, and a bunch of librarians would be billionaires. The mind and brain sciences can tremendously inform persuasion to determine decisions and results. How information is communicated can dramatically affect how it's perceived and acted on. The first principle of persuasion, liking. It sounds so simple. We like people who like us, who are similar to us in some way. We buy from people we like. We prefer to say yes to people we know, like, and trust. The application? Find something in common. Discover real similarities, genuine connection, and offer authentic comments. Here's a simple and goofy but meaningful illustration of that. When I was about 8 years old, it was time to buy a new coat for school. I went to the big city close to the little town where I lived on a farm outside that town of 720 people. We looked at coats at three stores because that's all there were. There were Penny's, Sears, and Monkey Ward's. Don't even ask. Because then at one store, I really liked the salesman. He was warm, engaging, funny, seemed to take a genuine interest in me. The coat I was looking at there was a light blue soft velour with an elastic bottom, not the kind of coat a farm guy would buy or dare to wear at your school. Sort of a balloon effect. Pretty much had to be there. He said, "Man, you look really good in that coat." Nobody had ever told me I looked good in a coat before. I knew right then that was the coat I was going to buy. I just had to convince my mom. I emphasized to my mom how much I wanted that coat. I didn't particularly like coat, but I sure did like that salesman. I liked the coat even less when I got home. That salesman had done a splendid job. I could not grow out of that coat fast enough. For 3 years, every time it got cold, I had vague memories of a really nice sales guy while I looked like my head was on top of a light blue marshmallow. So here's an application I'm going to call the Magic Johnson Principle. When my son and daughter were playing basketball in grade school and I was coaching their teams, we had season tickets for the Houston Rockets, two seats, and they would each do, my son and daughter, would do a draft at the beginning of the year to pick who went to what game with me, and we had dinner before the game. When the Lakers were in town, they were excited about seeing Magic Johnson, so I was sure they each got one game with him. Before the game began, I gave them a quiz. I said, "I want you to notice how Magic plays and see what you can pick up about his strategy, especially how he relates to everybody on the court." And I sort of a duly noted little nod. After the game, I asked each what they noticed in turn and to not tell the other when they went to get no trouble with that. They each mentioned how Magic seemed to be really great besides being a terrific player. Great friends with everybody on the court, including the opposing team members. What else, I ask? And the referees. He really enjoyed the referee. They seemed to enjoy him. Anything else? I nudge. They each mentioned in their own way some aspect of how much he actually fouled, but that he never seemed to be called for the fouls. Exactly. Everybody on the court likes him. All the players on both sides, and the referees, most of the fans even of the opposing team. And he genuinely seemed to like them. He was an expert at handling relationships as much as he was handling the ball. And they hardly ever called a foul on him. They did not want to interfere with that flow of enjoyment. They participated in his success. They would be less likely to feel that if they called a foul and disrupted the flow of that state of good energy experience with him. In his entire NBA career, and this is a record for starters, Magic only fouled out of 5 games. Most players will likely do that in the first quarter of the season for one season. When people like you and sense that you have something in common, they're more likely to say yes. It's the law of attraction in action. It's about energy fields and the communication of energy fields between people. People essentially do business with and refer business to those who they like, know, and trust. And those of you who have trained with me know how much I emphasize to work first with your lowest hanging fruit for referrals, because these are people who already have a relationship with you. And let them know, announce the opening of your coaching practice, the entire list of everybody you know anywhere in the world. People commit not to things, but to people who they believe care about them. So what are the factors that cause one person to like another person? They're not always visible and certainly not conscious. 4 are the most common. The halo effect. A halo effect occurs when one positive characteristic of a person dominates the way that person is viewed by others. Examples are kindness, honesty, intelligence. We're always teaching people how to respond to us. A second similarity. We like people who are similar to us, similar backgrounds, interests, age, religion, politics. Roger Dooley, author of BrainFluence, talked about this when he was an expert content contributor for my mastermind group and illustrated it by pointing out how I used something I knew we personally had in common in my introduction of him. A third compliment. The greatest car salesman in the world, acknowledged to be Joe Girard, said the secret of success was mutually liking clients. Each month, he sent every one of his more than 13,000 former clients a greeting card and personal message, and the message never varied. It read, "I like you." And people who knew him said he authentically meant it. My best friend through medical school and to this day, recently retired from his practice as a GI surgeon, he sent the announcement of his retirement to 7,000 of his patients and former patients, and almost every one of them responded, and he talked to say, it took him longer to retire. So, a fourth, contact and cooperation. Things that are familiar to us are most likely to persuade. By providing people with different backgrounds with more exposure to one another as equals, they come to like each other better. There's some excellent studies about race and class bias in a recent book. I'll reference that in our discussion and come back to it. Mr. Rogers carried in his wallet a statement that said, "Frankly, there isn't anyone you couldn't learn to love once you've heard their story." Here's an illustration. We're wired to socially connect with others. A study in Edinburgh planted hundreds of wallets on city streets. The wallets contained one of four possible photos: smiling baby, cute puppy, happy family, elderly couple. Other wallets had no photo at all. From these large number of people, here's the percent of wallets that were returned. With the baby photo, 88%. With the puppy photo, 53%. With the family photo, 48%. With an elderly couple, 28%. Those with no photo, 14%. No connection. The second principle of persuasion, reciprocity. We repay in kind. People return favors. When we help someone, they want to help us. This induces oxytocin, the brain chemical of connection and bonding. The application here is to connect with the person to give what you want to receive. Your income is determined by how many people you serve and how well you serve them. When we behave in a certain way, such as cooperatively, someone will respond in kind. We try to repay in kind what another person has provided us. It provides a sense of connection and closure. We have serious persuasive power immediately after someone thanks us. And a great response, of course, it's what partners do for each other. In a number of studies, reciprocity is so strong that it overwhelmed other factors. In one study, success in selling raffle tickets was way more effective for subjects who received a free Coke. The feeling of wanting to reciprocate to the giver resulted in buying twice as many tickets as those who had not been given the Coke. Think of the address label you get as a gift with a request for a donation. In one study, shoppers at a candy store made 42% more purchases when they received a small gift piece of chocolate when they walked in the door. Establishes a mindset, and a mindset determines the whole state of mind that we use in processing what happens then. When reciprocity is meaningful and unexpected, the size of the tips that food servers receive gets impacted. For example, to diners offered a piece of chocolate at the end of their meals by the waitress, tips increased 3.3%. to diners invited to take two chocolates from the basket, tips increased 14.1%. In another scenario, after offering guests one chocolate from the basket, turning away, and then unexpectedly returning to the table to offer a second chocolate, tips increased by 21.3%. Third principle of persuasion, social proof. We follow the lead of similar others, influencers, especially in ambiguous situations, and especially when we're uncertain. We do things we see other people doing, even more so if those people seem familiar to us. The application, provide a context to guide or demonstrate what behavior you want the person to engage in. Social proof is a way we determine at times what's correct or popular or acceptable. We find out what other people think about it. We even view behavior as more correct in a given situation if we see others performing it. And you've probably heard about this. In a study of donations to a street musician in Washington, D.C., researchers set two situations to observe the rate of donation to the musician. Then, at another match time, whenever someone was approaching the musician, one of the members of the study would drop some money in the hat of the street musician so that the approaching subject would see it. Viewing this act increased donation 8 times. In a follow-up, not a single one of the people who donated acknowledged or were consciously aware at all of being influenced by seeing the other person donate money. Instead, they came up with various rational reasons, like liking the music. This means that basing influence strategies on what people acknowledge that influences them have no better success or failure rate than random. People are often not consciously aware of what influences them or what to attribute as the cause. Now, add specificity here. A study in Great Britain found that the most remarkable success of getting people to pay delinquent taxes was the option that indicated the specific number of their fellow citizens living in their zip code who were doing it. They didn't want to be the outlier. Focus on behaviors that are frequently adopted and that are desirable, that have the client's best interest at heart. Social proof and other influence factors have to be both authentic and ethical, based on a true empathic and informational appreciation of what the client may need, want, and best benefit from. The fourth principle of persuasion, commitment and consistency. We have a deeply held motivation to behave consistently with commitments we've made, especially those commitments that are made public to others. The application here, write down or even state out loud a commitment. Then we're more likely to follow through. Think about the last question you ask, most likely, in a coaching session after you've asked the client to put it in an output channel to summarize in a sentence the most important thing they're taking away. And then, based on this, what do you commit to do before we meet again? So the client is specifying that, doing it out loud, and you're the accountability partner, and that client knows, after the first time or two at least, that's where you're going to begin if they don't, so they do a preemptive strike and give you a report. So they're way more likely to follow through when they do it out loud. Now, here's a study some of you have heard from me when you're looking at some marketing things with clients. There was a study done in a large number of the physician offices of large practices where there were randomly, as much as possibly, balanced selection. Half of the patients, when they left, were given the usual card with the date and the time of the next appointment set. The other half, the receptionist, asks the patient to write the appointment date and time. For those who wrote it themselves and put it in that little brief output channel and made a commitment to themselves by their own hand, 18% less no-shows for the ones who made that commitment by writing it themselves. So this is a variation that has a greater effect in a way than simply doing things in the usual way, a slight change, but yet one that makes a difference. The best chance a commitment will be fulfilled is when there's ownership of it. You've taken ownership by creating it and stating it. There's less commitment if somebody else writes out the plan or suggests what you do. We learn and remember best when we use an output channel, writing notes, talking about what we engage. We commit to what we create or co-create. That's a huge aspect of coaching to remember in working with clients. In instances where it's not reasonable for the client to actively participate in this way, it may be more productive to get a response such as an email to simply check yes to confirm an appointment. This enhances commitment rates also. These are all ways to help people take ownership of their own stories, to use that output channel. We each have a basic desire to be and appear consistent with what we've already done. Once we make a choice, we justify and rationalize that choice. We gather data to confirm it, confirmation bias, and selectively omit data that may refute it, inattentional blindness. These internal and external pressures will cause us to respond in ways that actually justify our earlier decision. So we live into the conclusion that we reach, sometimes not so logically and consciously. We make our beliefs and perceptions consistent with what we've already decided. This principle of consistency is powerful enough to direct both our perception and our action. We have a desire for consistency that is strong enough to be a central motivator and organizer of our behavior. Both our minds and brains incline toward the continuity of no change, to keep doing the same thing, the default mode. A body at rest tends to stay at rest, while a body in motion tends to stay in motion. And remember this with each client. Every step forward that's new or different, or any kind of change, will also have, as part of that subjective experience by the client, a little bit of discomfort, some trepidation, because they're departing from their familiar default mode that's hardwired, even though it may be limiting, even though it may have a glass ceiling, even though it hasn't resulted in exactly what they want. There's still the pull of the old and the trepidation of the new in every step forward. This is important to remember as we're listening to a client, perhaps empathically resonating, if they conclude that, well, it's my gut telling me it's a wrong thing, or my intuition says this is a bad choice. To recognize the discomfort is simply doing something different that they're not sure of how it's going to come, not sure how it's going to turn out, or banned that it's not what they do in an automatic way. So they can accurately read and then develop that self-reflection to recognize, even to reframe it as part of a progress note, a signpost of being in new territory, of validation, of moving ahead. So how can you make positive use of this consistency principle in your business? To obtain a large purchase, start with a small one as an introduction to the benefits you can offer. Findings show that almost any small sale will do, like an ebook for a couple of bucks, because that purchase of the initial small transaction is not really for profit, but for commitment to engage someone, to to collaboratively move ahead, to introduce yourself to begin a relationship. Further purchases, including progressively larger ones, flow from this commitment and this process. It initiates a relationship. So, the fifth principle, then, of persuasion, authority. We defer to experts and those in authority. The authority principle is an application, sort of the halo effect. So here, expose your expertise. Don't assume it's self-evident. This is not bragging. This is not marketing. This is not self-aggrandizing. This is simply representing yourself accurately. This may apply, for example, your website. When you need someone to advance your case or product or service, having an agent or an advocate can also be helpful. If you're perceived as being more prestigious if someone is advocating for you, this is the idea behind book blurbs or endorsements from respected authorities. This is why after you've done a coaching engagement, you may consider asking someone if they would do a recommendation for you that would appear on a website after coaching, because everything about the coaching is for the client. The sixth principle of persuasion, scarcity. We want more of what we can have less of. People value things more when they perceive them to be scarce. Opportunities and objects seem more valuable when the availability is limited. This is kind of a specific application of framing. So the application here highlights unique benefits and exclusive information. G.K. Chesterton said, "The way to love anything is to realize it might be lost." He was savvy about this principle. Here's an application. Caitlin, my granddaughter, who was 4 at the time, was playing with a stuffed bear in her pre-kindergarten class. Sarah, her little buddy, suddenly decided she wanted to play with that bear as well. There were many other toys around. There was no bear deficit, but Sarah was not satisfied until she had Caitlin's stuffed bear. Caitlin's mother, my daughter Lauren, a clinical psychologist, was rendered as helpless as Caitlin's absent granddad Dave in orchestrating her mastery to maintain possession of that coveted bear, or to work out a compromise for all-or-nothing 4-year-old possession-oriented minds. Caitlin will later learn how her own desires will be influenced by neuromarketing techniques based on celebrity induction, social valuation, and popular trending stuffed bears. Even the induced shortage of specific stuffed bears. But for now, she has only impromptu strategies to wrest that bear from the evil clutches of Sarah's immediate inspired desire. As all children do, they have a radar. They're born with a radar for scarcity, the unequal distribution of wealth, tangible or emotional, sometimes in bear language. Both girls were in the grips of the scarcity principle. When they saw something as rare or scarce, it became more valuable. It enhanced desire. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we react by wanting to possess it more. We counter that. Even later in their lives, Caitlin and Sarah will contend with marketing messages that are adult versions of the bear story. Limited number. Only two left. 1 day remaining. We're not making any more bears. Mimetic desire, meaning one person's desire mimicking that of another, is not limited to children, but plays a significant role in product adoption of best-selling goods. Our neural system contributes to this contagion of desire. The more valued the person, the more attention we pay in that mirroring process. The scarcity principle involves a secondary source of persuasion. as opportunities become less available, we actually lose freedom and choice, and we desire to preserve our established priorities. We want to couple not just what would be gained by acting or purchasing, but also what would be lost if it's not possible to act or purchase. The gain and the loss principle here. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we'll react most likely by trying to possess the item more than ever. A related tendency is to want what has been banned and to presume it's more worthwhile when it's limited. Louis Neisser said, "Some people will believe anything if you whisper it to them." Here's an illustration of this, and I knew nothing about neuromarketing or persuasion neuroscience, influence psychology at the time. This was totally intuitive, but I want to share with you because there's a principle involved here. Many years ago, after I had completed my subspecialty training in psychoanalysis back in the day when I still practiced analysis and therapy, I was invited to join the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Institute. I was even more excited when I was invited to offer a continuing education course in the evening for the professional community on any subject I chose. That was usually reserved for more senior analysts. I was warned not to be disappointed if the enrollment was low, because the highest subscription for any course that had been offered to date was 7 people. The average was 4 to 5. And occasionally, courses had to be dropped because there wasn't enough registration or no registration. This was an evening weekday for, I don't remember, hour and a half, 2 hours. The first thing I did when announcing the course was to stipulate, in order to ensure optimum discussion, a maximum of 12 seats available. I was an optimist, and I didn't know at the time about the scarcity principle, at least consciously or conceptually. In the first 2 days, 14 people signed up, and the waiting list grew. So a brief overview of these 6 universal principles of persuasion that apply the mind and brain principles. Liking and reciprocity highlight connectedness with others to generate positive association. Remember those 2 principles. Another principle, shared similarity. Being together and acting together creates a sense of unity, which activates the hormone of connection and bonding, oxytocin. Social proof and authority both reduce uncertainty, and consistency and scarcity both motivate action. So the most important thing in knowing and applying these persuasion principles is, again, to be authentic, to genuinely have your client's best interests at heart. Remember that all influence factors have to be trustworthy, genuine, ethical. The 4 primary tools of persuasion I want to review with you as a final section here. The 4 basic tools of persuasion: 1, relatedness and connection. For a long-term impact, you have to care about people and find a way to communicate that authentic feeling of caring and of connection. Empathy is a listening perspective of resonating with someone else's experience, including feeling, perspective, ways of determining meaning, that person's subjective reality, not just about feeling. Our ability to influence and persuade depends not only on our ability to empathically understand another person, but to communicate that understanding. This is always a first step to empathically resonate with someone to build a common ground of understanding. Everything else follows. A simple example. Your client calls you at the appointed time for your mentor coaching session. Begins with a kind of a toss-off comment, I'm just so totally overwhelmed with everything that's happening. I know I need to do. Your first response, hopefully, ideally, I would suggest, is not to get into the content and begin figuring out what the client needs. The first response is, I hear how overwhelmed you're feeling right now. Here's the principle. State always comes before strategy and story. and we'll talk about that as we talk about success mindset, to resonate with the client, to connect with them, and then to go someplace new with you. If you're not exactly right when you resonate, in fact, the other person appreciates that you've tried to understand and will correct you. When you listen empathically and communicate that understanding, the other person feels truly heard. This is the essence of effectiveness, to be understood. The experience of connecting with another person, as I mentioned, releases oxytocin in the brain of both parties, further enhancing affiliation and trust. The more people trust one another, the greater the collaboration and shared information. Now, here's the answer to the persuasion quiz done at Ohio State University that I began this seminar with. The answer, more than the next four combined, which are only markers, the answer is the generator of self-esteem. The students valued boosts to their self-esteem, such as receiving good grades or compliments, more than all four others combined. The second tool of persuasion, autonomy, having a determination, effectiveness over our environment, and the choices we make generates the experience of significance. The most basic desire that we have as human beings is to feel effective, to be a cause, to have agency. I've seen direct infant observation studies of kids as early as 3 months of life. There can be demonstrated an effectance pleasure, the pleasure of being a cause. And that continues throughout our lives, to be effective. That's exactly why you're doing maybe a sample session with a client, to give them the experience of the effectiveness of how coaching can be beneficial, and then to make a recommendation of what to do for the bigger picture. When you understand what people believe and need, you can then show them how your product or service will help them be effective to reach their goals, and especially to experience mastery. The third tool, certainty. The need to be certain that we can avoid pain and achieve pleasure is a fundamental human need. The brain is a pattern recognition machine that constantly tries to predict the near future. The act of creating a sense of certainty is rewarding. Think about how we all repeat the same patterns. We listen to the same music. We go back to the places we've been. We order the same or very similar items from the menu. We eat the same meal. Change generates uncertainty. No matter how much it's desired, no matter how much it will benefit someone, it generates uncertainty and a trepidation. Even a small amount of uncertainty cues the brain's error detection mechanism that says, this is not what I expect, reading as, this is wrong. This is just wrong, contributing to our resistance to change. We can increase certainty by making concepts tangible. So this is the question of what do we do then? We can increase certainty by making concepts tangible, such as how long a meeting will run, and explicit, such as objectives, or to outline for a client when you're setting up a sample session. It will give us both the best idea of what it would be like to work together in professional coaching if you had a specific focus and a goal of where you'd like us to get to in our conversation of 20 minutes. So that does two things. It says, this is not we're passing time instead of, you know, you're being on a jog and me sitting out by the pool. This is a specific purpose that we share, and to think about what you'd like to focus on and where you'd like to get to prior to that, and then begin with that, because that's going to create the maximum sense of effectiveness. And there's a certainty about what you're going to ask. So the person in preparation is not all over the map about their life problem. They're deciding on a specific focus. Much of the field of management addresses increasing a sense of certainty, especially at times of change and transition. Here's a principle. Whenever two people meet, the person with the greatest amount of confidence will influence the other. Confidence is a state of mind that infers certainty and is contagious. The energy fields of two people interact to create an intersubjective third. That confidence is going to be contagious, in other words. Now, these first three primary tools of persuasion comprise three of the six basic human needs: connection, autonomy, and certainty. The fourth tool of persuasion, state management. Manage your emotion and states of mind. And that's why we're going to spend a major part of one seminar on this particularly. Focus is one of the two most powerful ways we regulate state of mind. The other is physiology. Think about, for a mindfulness meditation minute, focus on your breath to create relaxation. Breathe in, relaxation. Breathe out, any tension. We determine someone's focus by the questions we ask. Asking a question is our most powerful tool to persuade someone by helping them focus specifically. And the way we ask the question frames the answer. We're going to explore this considerably more in the next seminar because that's how important I think it is. So here's a kind of a long sidebar, the art and science of explanation. A natural inclination is to point to all the available information and rationale for why people should pay attention to what you think they ought to pay attention to. When a medical doctor prescribes medication, over 50% of prescriptions are not filled. Of those that are filled, just over 50% are not taken as prescribed. That's the result of going to an expert and getting information, as we've discussed before. Strategies that attempt to form opinions, to inform people into a desirable change that you know they ought to do, have a high likelihood of failure. It's not information that leads people to make decisions or change their minds. We all, to some degree, have to overcome the curse of knowledge. The difficulty we may have in imagining what it's like to not know what we know. The killer pairing is wanting to share all of what we know. Like, that's going to be the remedy. One of the most profound challenges is to simplify. Although valuable, the knowledge we bring to the table, especially if we get into a teaching mode, is going to interfere with our ability to engage in conversation and communicate in a clear, simple, succinct way, especially using a collaborative model, which is so necessary. So, these following principles from a number of neuroscience studies will heighten impact and retention. And these are just brief. The four principles of good writing and good speaking: clarity, brevity, simplicity, humanity. That comes from what most writers consider the Bible of writing, The Art of Writing by William Zinsser. But it happens also to apply to speaking: clarity, brevity, simplicity, humanity. And what we know now from neuroscience, how true this is, when you speak to others, they're going to be fully able to attend and remember about 10 to 12 words before their retention begins to slip. And if it's a bunch of words past that, they're going to start playing what they had for dinner that night. Now, consider the 10-10 principle. A collaborator of mine, a buddy, Mark Wallman, Loyola Marymount Executive MBA faculty, did research using the 10-10 principle. He asked people who were participating in emotionally charged situations, divorce, mediation, negotiation, arbitration, and those who participated in his study, it was an authentic, whatever it was, divorce, mediation, they did the 10-10 principle. Each side would put up both fists and extend one digit for each word they used and agree to stop at 10 words. And the other side then did their 10 words. So they went back and forth, being clear, brief, specific. His research showed that in these charged situations, they were resolved faster, averaging 20 to 25% of the usual time. and they reach more satisfying and complete conclusions. He describes this and some related aspect in one of his books, Words Can Change Your Brain. So if this is such a proven principle psychologically, neuroscience, and intersubjectively, why not think about asking a question only using 10 to 12 words and then stopping? Other considerations to heighten impact and retention. Don't bury the lead. State in your first sentence what specifically you're going to address. Then, the benefits you bring. Secondly, listen carefully. Knowledge speaks, wisdom listens. Another, reduce noise. Include only what is simple and relevant, the essence of what you want to say. For example, if you ask a question which will engage somebody instead of giving them some information that they're going to start with seeing if they agree or disagree, when you ask a question, make it clear, specific, succinct. Then pause. Don't elaborate, explain, stack on another question, make it a multiple choice, or camouflage your opinion in the form of, well, have you thought about it? And lastly, have fun. States of mind are contagious. And this is from my favorite grandmother. I want to share her saying with you. It's my last book that's with my agent right now is dedicated to her with this quote from her. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. And she hasn't been wrong yet. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. I'm interested in what you think, questions, clarifications, or things you'd like to discuss just a bit more. And thank you, each of you, for holding down any background noise with the Star 6 until you're ready to talk. But I'm eager to hear from you and what you're taking away from this or any questions or clarifications from it. You've heard way more than enough from me. I want to hear from you. Anyone? Well, let me ask you a question. Is there any way to get college students to eat more healthily? Anything that you could think of to persuade them? A usual approach might be they're college students. They're bright. They're wanting to better themselves. Would be to sell them on the virtues of healthier food, the impact on their bodies, and related research. University of Minnesota researchers asked this question, but found that that's not what worked. In another group that didn't hear about the first group, they went about it in a different way than facts, information, and logic. In a typical lunch line at University of Minnesota, students encountered carrots next to more tempting options like French fries and pizza. So what they did was to shift the choice architecture. They gave the students a cup of carrots the moment they arrived in the cafeteria when they were most hungry. This set in an initial framework, maybe reciprocity, but also a framework of healthy food, and they ate significantly more carrots. They simply put the carrots in a competition the carrots could win, not against French fries, but against being hungry. Now, think about this. The principle here is something that we do every session in coaching. Interruption at the instant of an automatic default choice can simply shift a perspective to consciously consider the process or the alternatives rather than having it be just an unconscious and automatic choice. So we nudge a reflection, we ask a question, we highlight that someone is making a choice, and what do they think about it? What are the other choices? So anytime we interrupt that default choice or the process with a client, we're asking them to look at it in a different way. We're asking them to reflect on it. And this, I think, is one of the reasons the questions have such a powerful impact, because remember, 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. We make most decisions in an unconscious way without thinking about it, including things that may not be in our best interest. So this is what we're listening for as coaches, as we hear a client unfold their story and their discussion, their examination with us of something. Every algorithm that they have that's relevant in their choices and in their stories will manifest. You will hear, if you listen for the process, not just the content of trying to find something to fix or do something about, you'll hear the process that may be way more important than the content of what they're focusing on. You'll hear perhaps limiting assumptions like, well, you know, I need to be comfortable before I can start this, or I need to get motivated before I can exercise, or, you know, I need to find a way to do this that I can be certain about. Any limiting assumption, that's an immediate coachable moment. If there's an unconscious bias, boom, a coachable moment. Anything that you need to stop action and get a client to focus on with you in that process can be beneficial to a collaborative consideration of what they're doing. So this is simply an application. So again, I went a minute over. We will pick up 2 weeks from today. If there are any questions, comments, or things you think about, and especially those of you who may listen on the recording as well, fire off an email. I'll be eager to hear your responses, your questions, and wrap them into our discussion, or at the beginning or the end, or especially as we have an extended time in our last seminar just for discussion for things that we didn't get to that you may be interested in. So thanks very, very much, and I appreciate your responses and kind words. Fire off an email. I'll be eager to hear from you. Thanks very much. Take good care of yourselves. Till next week this time. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye, Dave.
Thank you so much.